This is Jim Inkster, and thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow producing. Our show originates from the Investar Bank Tower in Baton Rouge. And we're joined by Max Boot, a remarkable writer, Russian-born, naturalized American. He has written for the Christian Science Monitor, the Wall Street Journal, and he is now a biographer of note. He was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for Biography. Many remember The Corrosion of Conservatism, Why I Left the Right, which details Max's ideological journey from a movement conservative to a man without a party. And now, 8 years later, he's written Reagan, His Life and Legend, and it is about the 40th American president, who is a person with a complex legacy, as most people in public life have, but Ronald Reagan did serve as U.S. president for 2 terms. He was governor of California for 2 terms, did not run for office until he was 55 years old. And at the time when he got the nomination in 1980, Jimmy Carter, the president, who turns 100 years old tomorrow, really wanted Reagan as his opponent. He thought he was the most beatable of the Republicans, but Reagan ended up winning 44 states. And then 1984, in his reelection quest, he won 49 states. So he is the GOAT when it comes to electoral victories. In 2 U.S. presidential elections, he won 93 states and he lost 7. So that's a rather good mark, shall we say. And that just doesn't happen anymore. As we know, 36 days out from the 2024 election, we're probably going to have a race that is a photo finish. Your number, 877-217-5757, emails to talk at talklouisiana.com. And good morning to you, Max Boot.
Good morning.
It's nice to hear your voice, and congrats on your work. And many have tackled Reagan without much success. As we know, a fine writer, Edmund Morris, he couldn't do anything, and he had access to Reagan, but he just didn't have it. And I think he'd won the Pulitzer for a biography about Teddy Roosevelt. But you have gotten plaudits. You made the cover of the New York Times Magazine a week ago, Sunday. What was it about him that you found captivating enough to give a biography another shot of the man they called the Gipper?
Well, you know, when I started writing this book a decade ago, I knew that there were a lot of books about Reagan, but I didn't think that there was any great biography. There was no definitive work that really gave an objective account of his life and times. And that's what I set out to do, to write something that was neither hagiography nor hit job, but that instead would present Reagan in a very balanced and objective way, with both his strengths as well as his weaknesses, his achievements as well as his failures. And so I was very gratified just recently to see the review in The New Yorker, which said that Reagan, His Life and Legend, aims to be the definitive biography, and it succeeds. So that was kind of a mission accomplished moment for me, something, you know, very glad to see that the book was received in the way that I intended it when I wrote it.
The book is Reagan, His Life and Legend, a big book from W.W. Norton Publishing. And Walter Isaacson says it's a timely and fascinating book, just what we need to understand and perhaps transcend our current age of political paralysis and polarization. Understanding Reagan is key to understanding our politics today. And you note that, of course, there are similarities and there are distinctions between Reagan and Trump. But without Reagan, would there have been a Donald Trump?
Well, I don't know, you know, that Reagan necessarily made Donald Trump possible. And I think that there are certainly more differences and similarities between them. But there are also some continuities, and you can see how we got from one to the other. I mean, there is, you know, the discontinuities, I should stress, are pretty substantial, including the fact that Reagan was pro-free trade, pro-immigration, pro-NATO, pro-standing up to Russia. He had a very positive, optimistic view of America as a shining city on a hill, and he never denigrated his opponents in personal terms. So, again, difference is greater than similarities, but you can also see some similarities, including the fact that both Reagan and Trump were hosts of national TV shows before becoming president. They were both, populists who often denigrated the federal government. They sometimes engaged in white backlash politics, and they sometimes used assertions that were not strictly speaking factual. And so you can kind of see, you know, the Republican Party going from Reagan to Trump. But I'm sure that if Reagan were still alive, he would be very surprised that where it's wound up. I mean, the irony is that in 1980, when Reagan won the presidency, his ascension was widely and correctly hailed as being a turn to the right for the country and the Republican Party. Whereas today, if the Republican Party embraced Reaganism, he would be moving to the left. It would be returning to the center.
It is remarkable that Democrats now, as you note, on trade and on war are more like Reagan than Trump. And Trump is the Republican Party until further notice. 877-217-5757 is your number for Max Boot, and talk@talklouisiana.org is our email address. The book is Reagan, His Life and Legend. Bob Mann, who lives in this area, I thought wrote a fine biography of Ronald Reagan a few years ago. But this one is one that is gaining a lot of attention and a lot of praise, and other books about Reagan have fallen short. Lou Cannon wrote some good books about him, largely about his governorship of California. And you note that Reagan, despite the macho conservative image, he governed from the center, didn't he?
Absolutely, and that was one of the paradoxes of Ronald Reagan, that he could be very ideological when he was out of office. And in fact, some of his rhetoric was kind of reminiscent of Trump, because in the 1960s, Reagan was talking about how the Democratic Party was supposedly taking America forward under the banners of Marx, Lenin, and Stalin. So he sounded like he was, you know, very far to the right. And yet, when he became governor of California in 67 and president of the United States in 81, in both cases, he really pivoted to the center and governed in a very pragmatic and moderate fashion. For example, you know, as governor of California, he signed one of the most liberal abortion laws in the country and one of the toughest gun control bills. As president of the United States, he sometimes cut taxes, but he also signed bills to increase taxes. And in 1986, he signed legislation that legalized millions of undocumented immigrants. And finally, in his second term in office, he worked closely and cooperatively with Mikhail Gorbachev, the world's number one communist, to reduce tensions and to end the Cold War. That's the last thing anybody would have expected from somebody like Ronald Reagan, who was such a hardline anti-communist throughout his political career. And yet he was able to change with the times and pivot once in office. And I think that's a tribute to his pragmatism and an indication of why he's considered by historians to be a great president.
Well, he was a man of modest beginnings, and he was a sportscaster and then a movie star, but never an A-lister. He supposedly once was up for the role for Casablanca, but a guy named Humphrey Bogart got it instead. But he parlayed that into politics in the 50s, becoming a spokesman for General Electric, and becoming head of the Actors Union. And there is a mixed opinion about how active he was in outing people who were thought to be communists. Was he an activist on this front, Max?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he was pretty active in the Hollywood politics of the blacklist era in the late 40s, early 50s. He testified before the House Un-American Affairs Committee. He certainly named names in as an FBI informant. This was kind of his introduction to politics, and that's really where he became a hardline anti-communist, because he was convinced that there was a maid in the Kremlin plot to take over Hollywood, which I found upon further examination to be vastly exaggerated. But That is what he firmly believed, and he became close to the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover and others, and that was the beginning of his transformation from New Deal Democrat to very conservative Republican.
You have evidence about what would be an October surprise prior to the 1980 election. What happened in the race in October between Reagan and Jimmy Carter?
Well, the October surprise was the name given to this theory that Reagan aides, and in particular Bill Casey, his campaign manager and later CIA director, had reached out to Iran to suggest to them that they not release the U.S. hostages before the election, because Casey was very afraid that would give a big boost to Jimmy Carter. And this has been a controversial theory. There were, you know, a couple of congressional committees that investigated and determined that there was not much to it. But there has been more evidence that has come to light in recent years suggesting that, you know, I think there probably is something to it. It's still not proven beyond a reasonable doubt, but I think that it's more credible than not. There is evidence to indicate that Bill Casey was sending signals to Iran in 1980. But there's no indication that Reagan knew what he was up to any more than he knew about what was going on in the Iran-Contra affair later in his presidency. But, you know, these were some of the sordid machinations that were allegedly happening behind the scenes with some of Reagan's aides.
It's a big book, Reagan, His Life and Legend, from Max Boot, an accomplished writer. And we will spend a bit more time with him. If you'd like to get in under the wire, Robin Dow will take your call at 877-217-5757. We're back after this 89.3 second timeout. This is Jim Inkster. Max Boot is at the ready to answer your inquiries if you have them. 877-217-5757. We've gotten some emails, but his book is Reagan, His Life and Legend. And it is a big book about the 40th American president who was charismatic, and he lost races for the presidency twice before he got the nomination in 1980, and many thought he was too old in 1980. He was 69 years old when he was elected, at the time the oldest president ever, and he had lost narrowly to Gerald Ford in 1976. And people also forget that a week before the election, a Gallup poll had it a dead heat. I think Carter was actually a little bit ahead by about a point nationally. And then Reagan won an overwhelming landslide, and he did so largely on his debate performance. There was only one debate between Carter and Reagan, and it occurred days before the election, October 28th, 1980. Robin Dow has how Reagan closed the debate and made the case that he was a better bet. Let's go. Ronald Reagan.
Next Tuesday, all of you will go to the polls, will stand there in the polling place and make a decision. I think when you make that decision, it might be well if you would ask yourself, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? Is it easier for you to go and buy things in the stores than it was 4 years ago? Is there more or less unemployment in the country than there was 4 years ago? Is America as respected throughout the world as it was? Do you feel that our security is as safe, that we're as strong as we were 4 years ago? And if you answer all of those questions yes, why then I think your choice is very obvious as to who you'll vote for. If you don't agree, if you don't think that this course that we've been on for the last 4 years is what you would like to see us follow for the next four, then I could suggest another choice that you have.
All right. He was the great communicator. And Donald Trump's the one who talks about central casting. Reagan certainly looked presidential. And Max Boot, all those things helped him make the case. I remember Walter Cronkite previewing the debate, said it's a matchup between a peanut farmer and a movie actor. But Ronald Reagan was much more than a film actor.
Yeah, no, he was really a great communicator. And of course, by the time he became president, he'd also been governor of the nation's most populous state for 8 years and did a good job. In fact, you know, his Democratic successor, Jerry Brown, who was also the son of the man Reagan beat to win the governorship, Pat Brown, Jerry Brown told me that Reagan was a pretty good governor. And that's coming from a Democrat. So, you know, he certainly had a track record in government. And he had also, even before becoming governor of California, he had been speaking out on politics long before that, especially in the 1950s as a spokesman for General Electric and host of General Electric Theater on TV. He was constantly giving speeches and really learned how to give speeches and wrote them out on index cards and, you know, would shuffle the index cards so he never gave the same speech twice, would judge the audience reaction to see what worked, what didn't, and index cards that worked stayed in the pile. Those that didn't work were thrown out. So he became a very highly honed speechmaker, and that was long before he had a speechwriter. He was really doing his own speechwriting. In fact, Stu Spencer, his longtime political consultant, told me that Reagan was the best speechwriter, not just speech giver, best speechwriter he'd ever met. So that was what enabled him to win the 1980 election and helped him to become a success as president.
Now, listener Tracy at the Capitol notes that Reagan was elected in 1980. I mentioned at the time the oldest president. And he served 8 years, and then shortly after, 1994, in the overall scheme shortly after, just 14 years after he had been elected president, he acknowledged that he had Alzheimer's. Now, was there any evidence of an onset of this while he was president, Max?
I didn't really find it, and I looked for it. I talked to a lot of people, including his one of his neurologists, and what they basically told me was that kind of the plaques and whorls that cause Alzheimer's are often present in your brain long before the onset of the disease. And so Reagan probably had the precursors in his brain when he was president, but I didn't see any evidence that he had dementia. And in fact, if you read the letter that he wrote in 1994, when he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, I think that refutes any notion that he did have Alzheimer's, because he just sat down and dictated the letter on the spot, or wrote the letter out by hand on the spot. And it was just a beautiful, farewell to the American public, writing that he was riding off into the sunset and wishing the country all the best. So, he was certainly slowing down in his second term when he was in his late 70s, but I didn't see any evidence that he had dementia.
Now, listener Hallen Monroe asks about the fake quotes and fake statistics that Reagan would sometimes use in campaign speeches, and I think most politicians are guilty of hyperbole, but this may have been a precursor to Donald Trump. Did he do this often?
He did do it often. I mean, he certainly never claimed that immigrants were eating household pets, but he definitely had his own stock of kind of faux quotes and faux facts. He was particularly enamored of alleged quotes from communist leaders claiming to explain their plot to take over America by passing social welfare legislation like Medicare and Medicaid. And these are all phony quotes that were generally, concocted by the John Birch Society or other conspiracy mongers. I mean, Reagan's strength and his weakness was that he was a great reader. He loved to read. He read a lot. But he also was often kind of not a very discriminating reader. And so he would tend to read things that were apocryphal or not quite truthful, and he would believe it, and then it would stay. And he had a pretty good memory in those days. And so those fake facts would stay in his memory for a long time. And he would trot it out even after it was pointed out to him that it wasn't strictly speaking truthful. So, mm-hmm. I would say he certainly never deliberately lied, but he certainly had a kind of cavalier attitude towards fact checking. I think that's accurate.
The emails are coming fast and furious on this one, and a listener notes the story that he told often about the welfare Cadillac. Where did that come from?
Well, he told in the 1970s, he was fond of telling a story about a welfare queen who supposedly had a Cadillac and, lived a good life by collecting, benefits for a number of recipients. And it had a germ of truth, actually. There was a woman who was ripping off the welfare system. I think it was, in Chicago and other places. And that was written up in the press. And this was kind of a distorted version of that story that he kind of exaggerated. But I think the larger exaggeration was that he was trying to claim that, this kind of welfare fraud was very common. And, it was common for welfare recipients to be driving Cadillacs. And mm-hmm. that just wasn't true. That was the real exaggeration. But the fact that there was this notorious woman who was ripping off the welfare system, that was true.
What do you view as his principal accomplishment in his 8 years as president?
I think there were two, the first of which was that he really helped the nation to recover from the turmoil and trouble of the 1970s, the decade of Watergate, Vietnam, stagflation, the Iran hostage crisis. It was a really dark time when he took over, and he helped America to regain its confidence such that by 1984, he was able to run on a slogan of it's morning in America, and people believed it, and he won 49 states, which is an astonishing achievement. I think his other big achievement was what he did in his second term, working with Mikhail Gorbachev to peacefully end the Cold War, which was not something anybody expected from mm-hmm. somebody like Ronald Reagan, who had been an anti-communist his whole life. But he recognized that Gorbachev was a different kind of communist, somebody he could do business with, and the two men bonded at their Geneva summit in 1985. And then work together to reduce nuclear weapons and help to end the Cold War, even though many on the right were suspicious of Gorbachev, but Reagan developed trust in him. And I think that relationship was very important in peacefully ending the Cold War, a conflict that could have easily resulted in nuclear Armageddon.
Finally, a listener asked that Reagan, was he the first candidate for president to use the mantra, make America great again?
He was. He used it in 1980. That was one of his campaign slogans. But the funny thing is, when Ronald Reagan talked about making America great, one of the things he talked about, or one of the things he said made America great, was immigration. So very different from Trump. Reagan often paid tribute to immigrants. In his farewell address, for example, in 1989, he talked about the genius of America is that, you know, you can move to Germany or Britain or some other country.
And it's a great book from Max Boot. And we'll be back with Ron Stallworth after this timeout. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to Talk Louisiana, and your number is 877-217-5757. Emails go to talk@talklouisiana.org. We're with Ron Stallworth, another fascinating guest, and many of us are familiar with the film Black Klansman, and this is the best-selling author who inspired that film. He's back with The Gangs of Zion, a black cop's crusade in Mormon country, for those who might not be totally familiar with Ron. He's a retired police officer, infiltrated the Klan in Colorado Springs in the late 1970s, was the first African-American detective in the Colorado Springs Police Department. And in the 2018 film Black Klansman, Stallworth is portrayed by John David Washington. And you actually became a card-carrying member of the Klan, if I remember correctly, and your membership was signed by one David Ernest Duke, wasn't it not? Was it not, Ron?
That is true, and I still have that card. I've had it in my wallet since I got it back in January of 1978.
And as we know, you had some interaction with Mr. Duke.
I was his bodyguard when he came into Colorado Springs for a publicity blitz. My chief assigned me to be his bodyguard because he was getting death threats. And the chief told me, he said, I don't want anything happening to this man while he's in my town. We have nobody else available. You're it.
Were you surprised at all that he became a political force in Louisiana? He was elected once, albeit very narrow, to the Louisiana House, and he got 60% of the white vote in Louisiana when he ran for the Senate, U.S. Senate. And 55% of the white vote when he ran for governor. That really was not startling to you, I don't think.
No, it wasn't. I equate David Duke then to Donald Trump now. David Duke had a playbook that he ran on, and Donald Trump is doing the same thing. He's using David Duke's playbook to get elected by narrowing the vote, by appealing to white, so-called white causes like immigration and the such. And there's a lot of parallels to the two, but it didn't surprise me at all.
Well, we do have issues about race in the United States, and often it affects our quality of life. And you're a person who has seen it from various viewpoints as a law enforcement officer. And your new mission is to try to provide some clarity on this. And you also worked in the Mormon community, which, of course, is not known for racial inclusion. That's a big part of this book, A Black Cop's Crusade in Mormon Country. Tell us about your latest work.
I wrote this book. I had planned on writing something about the gang issue in Utah. I was the one who conceived the idea of a gang task force, multi-jurisdictional gang task force. It came about in April Fool's Day of 1989. It was called the Gang Narcotics Intelligence Unit. And it was my conception. The Salt Lake City Police Department bought into it, and it was housed under their department. And I was assigned to it by the Department of Public Safety, Utah Department of Public Safety Commissioner. That unit still exists to this day under the title of Metro Gang Unit. So 1989 to today, something that I'm very proud about. But when I came along in the 80s, cops in Salt Lake City were not allowed to use the term gangs. They couldn't put it in reports. They couldn't say it on TV if they were interviewed or anything like that. They could call them youth groups, community groups, you name the euphemism and they could use it, but not gangs. When I came along, I started using the word gangs. I said it at every opportunity, wrote it in every report where it was appropriate. And that's how we got started. And I always knew it was an interesting story. And it was just a matter of putting my mind to it and conceiving the idea and put it on paper.
877-217-5757 for Ron Stallworth. The title of the book is The Gangs of Zion, A Black Cop's Crusade in Mormon Country. And this is the gentleman who wrote about his life in Black Klansmen, which inspired the film. Rebel in Sherwood. Rebel, you're on Talk Louisiana with Ron.
Hi, thank you, sir. And thank you, Jim. Sir, I agree with you completely that Duke and Trump are both using what can certainly be referred to as the fascist playbook. Another similarity between Duke and Trump that I'm hope you know a little bit about is that they both have a real affinity for Russia and for Putin. In fact, isn't it true that David Duke had an office or may still have an office in Moscow?
I couldn't answer that. I know Duke had some appeal when he more or less left the Klan, got booted out, actually. He had some appeal with foreign governments, but I couldn't give you specifics about that.
Well, he went to St. Petersburg and taught at a university there and got, I think, an honorary doctorate. And so he now identifies himself as Dr. David Duke.
that I was aware of, the doctor title, but I didn't know the specifics behind it.
Well, he did enjoy his time in Russia. 877-217-5757 for Ron Stallworth. The Gangs of Zion is his book. Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, good morning. You're on. Good morning. Phil? All right. I think Phil is away from the phone. So, Robin, let's move forward. But, again, the number 877-217-5757. Ron Stallworth, according to Chuck D., the author and founder of Public Enemy, is a voice we need. He holds no punches in a page-turning memoir that fans of Black Klansmen will love. It's a unique perspective on law enforcement, tactics for creating effective change, and speaking truth to power, offers valuable insight on reforming our society. Now, we often talk with political people, either office holders or would-be office holders, and they're always talking about how they're going to fight crime, but that's easier said than done, isn't it?
Very much so. There is no formula for fighting crime, no specific formula for fighting crime, improving, making it better. A lot of it is just plain common sense. You have constitutional guidelines that you have to follow, and simply don't cross those lines of communication. Too many times when you see cops doing things that they shouldn't be doing, that's captured on camera or in audio, they have crossed the constitutional boundary, and it's uncalled for. What I have always advocated is that you can walk right up to that line, but you should not cross it. And what you don't do is, we have cops today that are so quick to want to go for their gun. I can understand that gunplay has gotten more prevalent in today's law enforcement versus when I was active on the streets 20 plus years ago, almost 30, in fact. Gunplay has gotten more prevalent, and you just have to use common sense in terms of when to use your gun. Mm-hmm. But you don't use it against unarmed suspects. You don't use it from a white versus black perspective. Just common sense.
All right. A couple of questions from listeners. One says, and I think she must have read your book, The Gangs of Zion, which is out now. But you had some collisions with Orrin Hatch, the senator from Utah. What was that about?
I gave a testimony in 1995 to House committee on keeping the Job Corps program intact. I had to take vacation time because my department would not let me go. So I took vacation time, flew to Washington at my own expense, and gave testimony at the hearing. I am an advocate for Job Corps. I believe in the Job Corps program. I think it's a good program when it's applied appropriately. But the problem was we had two Job Corps in Utah. One was run by the federal government. We had no problems with them. But we had another one, a private contractor, that ran a Job Corps program in Clearfield, Utah. Clearfield is about 30 miles north of Salt Lake City, 30, 35 miles. And the Clearfield Job Corps was bringing South Central LA Crips and Bloods into Utah. They were bringing Hispanic gang members from East LA into Utah, as well as gang members from Chicago, Kansas City, and such. Me and my partners in the gang unit would see these kids on the streets of Salt Lake City downtown on weekend passes. And it was at that time that they would start perpetrating their gang affiliations, doing graffiti, wearing the colors, talk to talk, walk to walk. Mm-hmm. Whenever I contacted anyone from the Clearfield Job Corps about this, they always insisted they had no gang members. They would say they used to be great gang members before they came here. And since they're affiliated with our program, they are no longer gang members. And I would call them out on it. So I gave my testimony, and Senator Hatch asked for a private meeting with me afterwards. I met with him in his office in the Capitol, and one of the things he said to me was, you have to be real careful with your words. He said, your words have a lot of power, and you have to be careful with how you use your words because you never know how it's going to impact the situation. And he told me he was very concerned about what I had just testified to and cautioned me to watch what I said. He didn't come right out and say, be quiet, don't say that, don't do that. He didn't come right out and try and bribe me, but I interpreted it as an attempt to bribe me and silence me.
The book is The Gangs of Zion, and it's from Ron Stallworth. You can hear this, the passion in his voice, a black cop's crusade in Mormon country, and this is the guy who gave us Black Klansmen. Congrats on your work, Ron. We'll be back, and if things go according to plan, we'll hear from Denny McLean. This is Jim Inkster, and you are listening to Talk Louisiana, and it's always a pleasure to catch up with Dennis Dale McLean, the man who won 31 games in 1968, and since 1934, when Dizzy Dean won 30, he's the only guy in 90 years to do it. And this year, Denny is quite proud that his Detroit Tigers are in the playoffs, and they have quite a pitcher, Tarik Skubal. He has won the equivalent of the baseball triple crown in the American League. He led the league in wins, strikeouts, and earned run average, and he's a guy who's kind of came out of nowhere. He's been on the Tigers for a few years, but this was his breakout season, and he led the league with 18 victories. That's the way things are now. 18 wins as opposed to 31 wins for our guest in 1968. Denny, I'm sure you're happy about the Tigers and their star pitcher.
Yeah, that you just hit me with the number. I didn't know he won 18 games. God, I think we had 18 by the All-Star break that year.
17. But, you had 17.
17?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Well, let me tell you one thing about this kid. This kid, I don't know where the hell he came from. I mean, I can tell you that I saw him throw in spring training a while back, and he just threw the hell out of the ball. And I asked a couple of people, I said, what's the matter with this guy? I said, not only is he left-handed, which is a precious commodity in Major League Baseball, and he throws strikes. I said, why isn't he in the lineup someplace? Why isn't he pitching it when he gets his chance? And nobody had a real good answer, but he's the best pitcher to come along, I think, in the big leagues in a while. He's down to earth. He throws the ball really hard. But the key to, and like I've told everybody in the world that's been willing to listen, the key to winning right-handed, left-handed, between your leg doesn't make any difference, is throwing strikes. No one's ever hit 500, 600, 700. I mean, one guy probably hit 400 one year, Teddy Williams, in the modern era I'm talking about. And, you know, I mean, it's just incredible. The ball club has played so well this starting in early July, middle July. I mean, we who watch these games all the time, we who are at the ballpark, I mean, we're just stunned. I mean, this ball club didn't hit a cutoff man the first 3 months of the season, didn't bunt once, didn't have a hit and run, run and hit. They made all kinds of errors. And all of a sudden, they look like the 1929 Yankees.
Well, Detroit's a great city and a great baseball city, as you know. And this team right now is the hottest team in baseball. And as you know, in the postseason, that's really what it's all about, how you're playing right now.
That's the name of the game. I mean, we're going to pitch this kid tomorrow night. And then it's a mixture of who else they're going to throw in there. At the break, they let a pretty good-looking pitcher go because they were trying to get some hitting. And whatever happened at the break when they let the one guy go for a couple of players, and they were mediocre players, what I was preaching and posting was, listen, you got the greatest athlete in Major League Baseball right now as far as pitchers go, left-handers. This guy should bring four or five stars. Not superstars, maybe, but maybe one superstar and some other players. But they didn't listen to my advice, which is okay. Uh-huh. And so they went to one another direction, and look where they are. Jimmy, I can't tell you how stunned we are in this town.
Yeah, there's a pep in the step when teams do well. Yeah. And you could probably feel it right now in Detroit, can't you?
Absolutely. I mean, everybody's jumping up and down. The Lions are playing well. They play tonight, of course. It's just crazy. The town is, it's been a long time since we've had two teams that had their fires lit. We got two ball clubs right now that are really burning high octane.
Mm-hmm. I don't think the Lions have won a title since 1957.
I think they won one just before the first Civil War, the early 1800s.
Well,
we've never had the crew.
Yeah, well, you talk about some characters in Detroit when you were in your heyday. Alex Karras was in his heyday.
Oh my God,
I'm sure the two of you probably had a beer or two.
Well, Alex and I used to talk about how good looking he was compared to the horse he was riding.
And Blazing Saddles, you know, yeah.
Alex was great. Alex was the perfect guy to play professional football because, you know, the guys then didn't have the equipment these kids have today. And you would see these guys in the clubhouse after a game, and they looked like they'd been through a street fight in the south side of Chicago. It was unbelievable how they looked, and, of course, a week later, they were out there doing it again. So we've had our characters here. We had Bobby Lane here, one of the greatest quarterbacks in the history of the NFL. Bobby, as long as he got his scotch in the morning, he was going to have a great game. But if he couldn't find the scotch, he didn't want to play.
Yeah, he was something. And of course, he went to Texas at the same time, same class as Y.E. Tittle and LSU, kidnapped Y.E. and brought him back from Austin to Baton Rouge. And,
of course,
Bobby Lane did pretty well, as we know. But Denny, a listener asked a good question. You know, I'm a purist. I liked it better when you had the National League winner facing the American League winner. Now we got all these teams in the playoffs, and you got to win three rounds, and it's not an easy process. But, of course, it brings revenue, and it, of course, creates more activity as far as teams that have a chance to get to the postseason. Your thoughts about this evolution and whether it's been good for baseball?
Well, I was there in the late 60s when they started this, when they started expanding, because I think we were one of the last teams that played in a straight-up World Series where the National League, American League, no playoffs, nothing like that. But I really liked the excitement of it the last couple of weeks of the season. And I firmly believe, much like the NBA and hockey, my God, almost every team makes the playoffs. And I don't think, you know what, and I don't think that's a real bad idea. I don't know how you can stimulate it whereby the public will bang it and want to be a part of it. But I think one more club in each division, or maybe two. American National League, it might be the answer, but I like the excitement at the end. I mean, look at all the things that happened this past weekend. I mean, clubs got in, clubs didn't get in. Tonight, we're flying down to Houston to play Verlander. But Verlander, of course, and we haven't figured this one out yet. Why they pitched him yesterday, we'll never figure that one out. Because he should have been opening up tomorrow night. I suppose they're looking for a game three, but hell, they got to win two. They have to win at least one to get to game three.
Yeah, well,
and our left-hander, he's not going to give up many runs.
Well, Verlander is a guy who's in his 40s now, and he's still doing it. Now, he's not what he was, but he started at a pretty high level. And Denny, he's one of those guys who he's a beneficiary of modern medicine. If you'd had the resources he's had, you would have been around a lot longer, too.
If we'd have just had the operation, I think I would have played another 10 years. I mean, first of all, I love the game, and I would have done anything to be able to play again. But you know, as they say, poop happens and you just keep marching along and you find something and you keep going.
Now, listener, this is, Robin says, a gentleman in New Orleans, what's his name? Jackie. He asks about the Oakland A's moving to Las Vegas. You actually played for the A's briefly with Reggie Jackson on a championship team, but you got traded to Atlanta. But what about that? You know, that park was lousy, but it had some charm and it had some history. That's kind of a shame, isn't it?
Well, I swear to you, you could have landed a 747 in it. That's how big that park was. I mean, the stands were so far away from the field. That was one of the biggest problems with it. Of course, now they finally got the new ballpark in Vegas. But you know what? I think it's going to be great for the game. The gambling thing, we're over the hump with the gambling thing. Everybody gambles now. Everybody's got a casino every block where you live now. Because once Michigan went, everybody else is coming anyway. And it's just incredible that I'm not so sure the first or second year the Oakland should do well with attendance. But I don't think if they don't play well, I don't think the city of Vegas will support them very long. And that now they're stuck there in a $1 billion stadium.
And some hot nights in the desert.
Yeah.
Well, Denny, we certainly want to talk to you in the postseason. And good luck with the Tigers. They're overdue. I hope they do really well.
Me too. You call anytime, Jimmy.
Love you. Take care and keep going. Dennis Dale McLean. He won 31 and 68, 24 and 69. No man's won 55 games in two seasons since, not even close. And yesterday we lost Kris Kristofferson, age 88, born in 1936, June 22nd, Brownsville, Texas. He came to the Manship Theater in 2018, but he had a full life, shall we say. He was a Rhodes Scholar. And he says, I think between Bill Clinton and me, we've settled any lingering myths about the brilliance of Rhodes Scholars. He also was a captain in the U.S. Army, 1960 to 65. And he was in the Tennessee National Guard, a young strong songwriter trying to make get a break. And he was washing floors at a record studio, a recording studio, and he got a promise from Johnny Cash. And Cash didn't deliver on it, so Kristofferson flew a plane into Cash's compound and asked him if he'd record Sunday Morning Coming Down. And Cash did it, and it was a big hit, and that made Kris Kristofferson a star, and he later, of course, became a star on the big screen. A handsome guy, brilliant fella, and perhaps the best songwriter of his generation. And here is Kris Kristofferson's version of Sunday Morning Coming Down.
Well, I woke up Sunday morning with no way to hold my head. Didn't hurt. And the beer I had for breakfast wasn't bad, so I had one more for dessert.
And he also gave
us Then I fumbled through my closet.
Me and Bobby McGee. Goodbye, Kris. We're back tomorrow. Stay tuned.